So welcome everyone, this is Jorge Fascinetti and you're listening to another exclusive podcast with Pituitary World News. Today we're in beautiful Sausalito, California, talking to Dr. Lewis Blevin about one of those fun-related conditions that affect a great number of people with acromegaly. Today we're talking about sleep apnea, and as you know, sleep apnea can have a definite impact on quality of life in acromegaly. And there are a few kinds of sleep apnea, so why don't you tell us a little bit about the different types of sleep apnea that you find. And welcome, Dr. Blevins.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you, Jorge. And I hope that those of you listening to Pituitary World News who have acromegaly or maybe some other disease process but have sleep apnea will find this to be of interest. Sleep apnea is a term that is used to describe people who actually stop breathing during their sleep. There's a related term called sleep hypopnea where people breathe less during sleep, and the two are probably on a spectrum of the same disorder where you have decreased breaths during sleep and then you actually stop breathing during sleep. There are two main types of sleep apnea. One is called central sleep apnea where the respiratory drive centers in the medulla oblongata of the brainstem aren't working properly, so there's no drive to breathe. And that can be related to interpretation of oxygen or carbon dioxide levels. And then there's what we call obstructive sleep apnea, where one has obstruction to airflow through the airway passages, the upper airway passages, to get air down into the lungs.
So what are the changes in the body that occur in people with acromegaly result in sleep apnea?
Well, there are a number of different changes in the soft tissues and the bony tissues in the upper airway that ultimately lead to sleep apnea. So there's thickening of the tonsils, the adenoids, the palate gets larger, the tongue increases in size, the mandible changes its configuration. There's soft tissue enlargement in the back of the pharynx and also the bony areas in the back of the throat and the neck. And all of that together leads to narrowing of the airway, which can collapse as you inspire. You create negative pressure in this area, and that can lead to collapse of those tissues during sleep.
So one of the things that you notice, I guess physically, that would lead someone to think that you have sleep apnea?
Well, as a physician, one of the things that we often notice is the size of the tongue and actually the speech pattern that the patient has, and I can almost predict based on how they're enunciating their words, whether they would more likely than not have sleep apnea. Oftentimes, the patient or their partner will talk about the fact that they snore or stop breathing during sleep, and those are some of the cardinal findings in sleep apnea. But Jorge, I know that you've been diagnosed with sleep apnea, so why don't you review with us some of the symptoms and signs that you had that ultimately led to your diagnosis?
Well, definitely what you're talking about, snoring. My wife noticed that snoring way before I was diagnosed with acromegaly. And she was always concerned that there was something going on because she had noticed that I was stopped breathing, like you mentioned earlier. So that was a sign. And I guess that was the main sign, the snoring.
So were you having any headaches or fatigue or trouble with excessive tiredness during the day, needing to take naps in the afternoon, for example?
Well, definitely general tiredness. I don't remember having to or want to take naps, but I definitely remember being more tired and not sleeping well, waking up in the middle of the night, sometimes two or three times, which was very unusual.
Some patients talk about the fact that they don't have restorative sleep, meaning that the sleep did not restore them to a level of function they wanted in the morning. Did you experience that?
Absolutely.
That?
That's very true. You don't fall asleep at the same depth of sleep that you do before when you first fall asleep.
Now, some of the other problems that people can have as a consequence of sleep apnea, including hypertension, stroke, cardiovascular disease, are fairly common. Is that your understanding as well?
Yes, it is. And I had, as you know, hypertension, that's one of the other signs. I don't have cardiovascular disease, but definitely hypertension. And I know that, for example, my hematocrit has been higher and much lower now since I've been sleep apnea therapy.
Yeah, it's conceivable that chronic low levels of oxygen could have led to the polycythemia that you experienced.
Yes. So how common is the problem of sleep apnea in acromegaly?
Well, Well, it's an interesting question. The incidence reported in various studies depends on the degree that the diagnosis was pursued. For example, if you just ask patients to self-report sleep apnea in a series of patients with acromegaly, you're going to probably see a lower number. But if you do sleep studies, you're going to see a higher number. So as a result, what's out there in the literature is anything ranging from about 54% in one study to another study where they actually did sleep studies on patients with acromegaly and found that 97% of patients had sleep apnea or sleep hypopnea. In another study, it was 83% of individuals had sleep apnea. So the overall message is that there's probably a higher incidence of sleep apnea in patients with acromegaly, whether there are symptoms or not. And I'm now practicing medicine with the belief that probably everyone with acromegaly should probably have a sleep study to evaluate to see whether they have the disorder or not.
Wow, I definitely had one, and believe me, they're not that much fun when they get wires all over the place.
I don't think I'd be able to sleep at all.
I don't know how I did, to be honest with you, but I did sleep enough so they could test it.
Yeah, I think the diagnosis, if I had wires hooked to me when I was trying to sleep, would be, he can't sleep. So
how about the frequency of acromegaly in a group of people proved to have sleep apnea?
Well, that's where it gets very interesting, because we often talk at Pituitary World News about early diagnosis and treatment and sort of the pathways to diagnosis. And I firmly believe that sleep apnea is one of those pathways to diagnosis, so to speak, in that it's often the first symptom or sign that people have. And if they would just be evaluated for the disease process, you could diagnose it sooner rather than later. And there are a couple studies out there, and one of them, it showed that the incidence of acromegaly proven by biochemical testing and physical exam was in 1.35 cases per 1,000 persons who had obstructive sleep apnea. And then in another study, it was 0.35% of people. But if you took a look at the 1.35 cases per 1,000 and looked at the annual incidence of new cases of acromegaly, that makes acromegaly about 225 times more common in a population of people with obstructive sleep apnea than it is in the normal population. And with that kind of a risk to have the underlying disease, it certainly makes sense to me that physicians who practice sleep medicine and evaluate people and diagnose them with sleep apnea should be evaluating patients for acromegaly.
So at least suspect it. Put it in the list of this should be checked.
Absolutely. I'll tell you about an interesting patient that I experienced many years ago, and happened to be a gentleman who had sleep apnea, went to see his physician and was diagnosed with sleep apnea, and the physician checked an IGF-1 level but never looked at the result. The level was markedly elevated, and it wasn't until 5 years later when the patient presented with pituitary apoplexy and irreversible blindness as a result of the apoplexy.
Oh, wow.
That he was diagnosed with acromegaly. So it's a really tragic story that could have been a different outcome had the physician simply looked at the lab test that they had already ordered.
Yeah. Does the presence of sleep apnea modify or change your approach to a patient going to surgery?
Well, it certainly does. Due to the enlargement of the tongue, some patients can have difficulty with intubation and have difficulty coming off the respirator after surgery in the postoperative arena. So we tend to try to assess the severity of the sleep apnea these days, and I would have to say that if a patient had marked sleep apnea, I would treat with medication first to try to decrease the size of the tongue and the airways to improve the likelihood that they would go through surgery more successfully. Most patients do go straight to surgery without any pretreatment. But in this day and age, I think it's best probably to pre-treat those patients who have severe illness. And it really, patients are the ones who taught me those lessons. I had one patient who took 3 weeks to come off the ventilator, needed a tracheostomy, and ultimately had post-traumatic stress disorder as a consequence of the problems that he encountered during the hospital stay. And another patient was in the ICU for about a week, and we couldn't get him off the ventilator. And I felt like with both of these gentlemen, pre-treatment prior to surgery would have alleviated the problem so that we wouldn't have had those respiratory complications of surgery.
So we're talking about the complications of surgery. So that's a good segue. So let's talk about the different treatments of acromegaly and how they impact sleep apnea.
All right, so our goal with treatment is to reduce growth hormone and IGF-1 levels to normal. And it doesn't matter how you do that, you will improve the sleep apnea in different patients. Most studies have showed that if a patient undergoes surgery and has successful resolution of their acromegaly, you'll have improvement or resolution in the sleep apnea. Some of the early studies suggested about 70% of patients with surgery alone will have improvement or resolution of their sleep apnea, whereas 30% will still have symptoms and signs.
Oh, definitely. I felt that a marked improvement after surgery with the sleep apnea, and my wife will tell you that I was much better after surgery.
And yet you were still formally diagnosed after the operation.
A few years later with mild sleep apnea.
Yes, interesting. I should have taken a look sooner. So in those patients who are not rendered disease-free with regards to their acromegaly as a consequence of surgery, we obviously approach them with medical therapy or radiation, and we use a number of different classes of drugs, the somatostatin receptor antagonists, the somatostatin analogs, dopamine agonist drugs. And the bottom line with each of these therapies is that sleep apnea resolves in about half the patients. All of these studies have showed decrease in tongue size, decrease in soft tissue size, improvements in respiratory disturbance indices, marked improvement in symptoms, etc., etc. The bottom line, though, is that some patients still are going to require additional treatment, whether it be CPAP, surgery on the palate, mandible surgery, or a combination thereof. So in your case, Jorge, you were diagnosed years after the surgery with mild sleep apnea, and I understand you did start treatment. Why don't you tell us about the therapy that you're on at the present time?
Yeah, well, I was, I thought, honestly, that I was feeling so much better after the surgery that the sleep apnea was resolved.
So let me interrupt you here and tell me what the sleep study was like. Tell us what that's what's to be expected for those who might be asked to undergo a sleep study.
Well, sleep studies are very interesting because I think they wired every part of your body and every response that they could possibly get from you that they want to measure while you're sleeping. And with thousands of cables hanging from you, they ask you to go to sleep. And the interesting thing about it is that they're watching you.
On a monitor.
That's
interesting.
And then they say, go to sleep. And I remember vividly, as I was trying to go to sleep and turned around, the nurse came on the loudspeaker saying, would you mind sleeping on your back?
Sleep on your back.
So I took a while to fall asleep, but I think I fell asleep long enough for them to be able to do a diagnosis.
Interesting.
And according to the sleep doctor, a very good test, and he was able to at least say that I had mild sleep apnea and made some recommendations on.
So they didn't give anything to help you sleep? No music, no pills, no...
No, nothing.
TV, no dreamscape created for you? Just
No, I couldn't watch any TV program to fall asleep on.
Interesting. Yeah, I wouldn't sleep at all. I'm pretty sure about that. So you said they made some recommendations for you. What did they recommend specifically?
Well, they recommended I use a CPAP machine, which I have to tell you, it takes a while to get used to it. But once you get used to it and it's comfortable, it works very well. I remember vividly putting this the first time the nose contraption and felt like I was being waterboarded. There's so much air coming into the nose. Just, I don't think I can sleep with it.
So you strap this thing to your face?
You do. It's a very comfortable strap, and then there's two little adapters that go right in your nose, and you have to breathe through your nose. Otherwise, you have to use a whole mask. And thankfully, I was able to learn to breathe through my nose and not have to use a mask.
Interesting.
So it's much more comfortable to have the nose contraption than the whole mask.
And this is hooked up to a machine that's at your bedside?
Correct. It's a little machine that has a humidifier and air that just sends a certain amount of pressure. And the pressure varies depending on how much the machine thinks you need, how much air you need. So it goes from 6 to about 20 PSI.
So what's wrong with these sleep doctors? You can't sleep during your test. How in the world can you sleep with this contraption? Do you get used to it?
That's a good thing. I totally got used to it. Now I sleep really well with it. And I remember going traveling and not taking it, one night travel and not sleeping with it. And I kind of missed it because it's nice to have that air in your nose. It's very pleasant after you get used to it. It takes a while to get used to it, though.
So tell us about what you've noticed about your sense of well-being since you started treatment.
Well, I definitely feel less tired, no doubt. And my blood tests have become a lot more normal. So my hematocrit is down to the normal level. It seems like I'm getting enough oxygen during sleep not to warrant anything, to have to do anything else.
Okay, how about the snoring? I imagine
The snoring is much better. Okay. I can tell you the funny story that now what wakes Carol up is that sometimes when the machine slips off your nose, it starts blowing really. this is funny.
It's a hurricane in the bed.
Hurricane in the yes. A lot of air. I don't know if that's better than snoring or the air coming out of the machine. It's interesting. It's funny.
And you showed me a pretty nifty app on your phone. Tell us about that, how you monitor your sleep apnea and your machine settings, etc.
Yeah, well, the app is really interesting. It's called My Air, and it tracks the number of usage hours. So it tells you how many hours you use the machine. Anything over 7 hours of usage, continuous usage, is marked very good. And then it tracks your mask seal to make sure that there's no air. Usually, there's never a mark, you know, that it says you didn't have enough, or there was an air leak. And then it tracks your events per hour. So anything below 5 apneas or hypoapneas is considered to be minimal or normal. And then it tracks your how many times you took your mask on and off. So if you get up in the middle of the night, the machine goes off, and then it comes back on. And you have to turn it on when you get back to bed. And that usually, it gives you 100 points and it deducts it for any of the, higher points, like in the events per hour or less than 7 hours sleep. Then you can track. Go ahead,
sir. So this machine now monitors your sleep apnea therapy and can communicate with your iPhone to give you information about
of my sleep.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and it communicates directly with the sleep app, the sleep doctor, and his office, so they can modify the machine if they see anything that needs adapting based on how the report is.
Interesting.
So I've been very happy because the last couple of months my sleep reports have been great, and it's a factor of just getting used to the machine.
Does it give you an idea of how long you slept at night?
Yes.
Or you know that, I'm sure.
Yeah, so...
Does it tell you what your awake time and your sleep time was? Can it sense that movement?
No, it tells you... No, it doesn't. Okay. No, but I know there's some applications now with either the new Apple Watch or the Fitbit that are attempting to track that, although I've been reading different reports on it, and it doesn't seem to be very accurate yet. Mm-hmm. But that would be a very helpful situation.
This is an interesting diagnosis, that of sleep apnea, especially as a consequence of acromegaly, and it's pretty nice to see that technology is now interfacing with our therapeutic machines.
Yeah, it's wonderful.
To give patients and doctors feedback about the success of treatment.
Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful because it makes it so much easier to modify if you need it, and to get it to work in its optimum capacity.
I think it also probably engenders a sense of personal responsibility and participation in care to know that you have an app and your doctor can look at the same information that you can look at on your phone.
Oh, definitely.
We'll certainly know whether you're compliant with treatment because we're getting the data.
Yeah,
but whether you're using your machine. So this has all been very interesting to me, Jorge, to learn more about your course of therapy for sleep apnea, and I'll have to admit that it's led me to investigate the disease process and the consequence of acromegaly in greater detail, And of course, you, along with my other patients, have helped me understand the practice of medicine and led to my medical decision making going forward. I've really enjoyed this chat, so it's been a tremendous opportunity for us to get together for this podcast.
Well, likewise, every time I sit down with you and chat, I learn something new also. So it's very interesting. Thank you for taking the time to do it. I know this is going to be very helpful to all of our listeners.
All right, so this is Dr. Lewis Blevins and Jorge Fascinetti from Pituitary World News. Thanks for listening. Have a good evening.